FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and it's 6618. Well, we always like new books, you know that. But first, join the discussion, make my day, send me an email to kl@kerrylutz.com. So the lessons of history, so important, really something you should never stop learning. The only way to really have any insight into what the future may hold is to really look carefully and closely and study the past. And there's a lot in the past, just like there's a lot in the present that you don't know about that's happened. Rick Richmond, author, you've seen his work all over Commentary Magazine, New York Sun, PJ Media, you name it, has written a lot of books. Last one was What America Owes the Jews, What Jews Owe America. And then the latest book, Rick, is something really interesting, Racing Against History, the 1940 campaign for a Jewish army to fight Hitler, something I never even knew about. But hey, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So this is a really interesting story that's little known to many of us out there who think they know a lot about World War II, about recent history. How did you come across the story?
Well, it was a mystery to me, and I found it kind of the way you find everything in life, by accident while I was looking for something else. I was doing some research on Zionism in the early part of the 20th century, and I found out that one of the three great Zionist leaders was in New York in 1940. It seemed a strange place to be because in 1940, America was frozen in isolationism. So I wanted to find out why this guy was there, and I found out he was there to try and generate support for a Jewish army to fight Hitler in the first year of World War II. And then I found out that one of the other of the three great Zionist leaders as of 1940 was there before him, and the other, David Ben-Gurion, whom I'm sure all your listeners know, was there after him. And the more I looked into it, the more I discovered a story that, like you, I hadn't known before. And it turned out to be quite an extraordinary story. I thought maybe at first a magazine article, but eventually it turned into a book.
Okay, so basically, these three great Jewish leaders were urging the U.S. to support a Zionist army to fight Hitler, if I've got that right, correct?
Yeah. So in the middle of 1940, as anybody who's seen the movie Dunkirk or Darkest Hour last year knows, Britain was on the ropes militarily. It was the military lowest point of World War II because the Nazis had, by the middle of 1940, overtaken all of Europe. France had fallen. The United States was nowhere near ready to come to Britain's aid. And the Zionist leaders realized that the Jews could fill in an important gap. And the reason was that they had formed a Jewish legion in 1917 to assist the Britons in Palestine against the Ottoman Turks. And they were prepared to do it again. It was the first organized military force in two millennia. And so it was a realistic thing. It was not idealistic, symbolic, quixotic. It was an actual attempt to generate support for between 50,000 and 100,000 men to form a Jewish army and join the fight.
Yeah, and that is, I guess, it makes a lot of sense. Zionism was alive and well then, obviously. How was this group of men, how were the three of them received by the U.S., and what ultimately resulted from their efforts?
Well, so there were three of them. Chaim Weizmann came in January to March. Vladimir or Zev Jabotinsky from March until August, and David Ben-Gurion left London, in September, stayed throughout the entire year. So there was one of the three great Zionist leaders in America the entire year. But in sort of an old Jewish story, they weren't talking to each other. They weren't coordinating. And their reception depended upon the time of the year. When Weizmann got there at the beginning of 1940, he found that America wanted to have nothing to do with this new European war. Only two decades after America had joined World War I in the hope of making the world safe for democracy, and exactly the opposite had happened with 100,000 American casualties. So 80 to 90% of American public opinion did not want to have anything to do with the European war, and people like Charles Lindbergh and Father Coughlin and others were counseling that nobody should think of American participation. When Jabotinsky came in the middle, he got a better reception. The situation was becoming increasingly bleak for Britain, for the Jewish people, eventually for all of Western civilization. By the middle of the year, he got a better reception. And Ben-Gurion, who came at the end of the year, when things were now obviously known to virtually everybody in America, also received a good reception. But tragically, not even the three of them could coordinate their efforts. And we know the end of the story. There was no Jewish army.
Right.
But the effort was heroic, and the response was surprisingly good.
So, you know, FDR was not exactly a lover of the Jewish people.
No.
Ships being turned back to Nazi Germany. He could have interdicted the rail lines heading to death camps like Auschwitz in the latter stages of the war. He chose not to. I mean, do you think that had something to do with it, or was it just disorganization and the inability of the United States to get its arms around the fact that this war was going on and American involvement would eventually occur?
Well, the failure to bomb the railroad tracks to Auschwitz, that was in 1943. So that was, you know, several years beyond the story that I'm telling. But as part of the story that I told, I came across through the research that I did through the archives of Weizmann's papers, a memo about the meeting that he held with FDR in February of 1940. And when you read that memo, it breaks your heart, because you can tell that that Roosevelt, though he's seen Weizmann, and Weizmann is the most prominent Zionist leader in the world, he's sort of putting him on. He's making jokes. He's saying, after the war, of course, we'll solve this problem, and maybe the Jews can go to Colombia in South America. It's just not a serious conversation that Roosevelt is engaged in. So, yeah, it sort of presaged the attitude that he would take in subsequent years. His defense, or the defense of those who support him, is that the main thing was to win the war. He had a world war on his hands eventually, and even the Jewish interest was an interest in defeating the Nazis as quickly as possible without diverting military resources to things like bombing the tracks to Auschwitz. It seems like a callous response, but it's understandable in terms of the times in which everybody was living. So, I have sympathy for both points of view, but I do come down that FDR was certainly deficient, and probably, had it been Truman rather than FDR in 1948, when the Jewish state declared its independence, not at all clear the United States would have, as Truman did, recognize it promptly.
Yeah, little disturbing. Hate to like look back in history and say shoulda, coulda, woulda, because it just doesn't work that way. And you're second guessing people's decisions made in an entirely different context from which you're judging. However, even considering that it wouldn't have been a major diversion of resources to bomb those rail lines and to cut off traffic to other death camps, you got to wonder, but I guess it'll remain a mystery. I just find it really interesting that these stories come up. Just like every now and then there's a new person who is introduced to the public, who saved hundreds, even thousands of Jews from the Nazis during the Holocaust by whether it's visas, whether it's Schindler's List, whatever. You know, the stories just keep coming up that how much do we really know about what really took place during World War II other than the highlights that are published in American textbooks and the numerous books that have been written?
No, it's an excellent point because, I'm not a professional historian, but I did a lot of research on this, and it amazes me that I was the one to find this story. It's told in some academic volumes and mentioned a bit in some biographies, almost in passing. But the effort that these three Zionist leaders made in 1940 was heroic, and we owe it to them to remember what they did. Simply to cross the ocean from Europe to America, when there were German submarines patrolling it and sinking ships with civilians and children on it, was an act of courage. And spending months in World War II in a isolationist country, trying to alert them to what was happening in history, and that history would not leave them alone, eventually, was an extraordinary story. And what amazed me was we know the ending. There was no Jewish army, at least not in 1940. But we don't know the story itself. And the story itself reads like a detective story or a suspense story, because there's so many points in time where if something had been done differently, or a different direction had been chosen, or different people had been in certain meetings, history itself would have changed. So it's a lesson to all of us, I think, in the current time, that, you know, we don't know what's going to happen next week, next month, this year in the world. But we certainly have more sources of information than people did in 1940. We've got 24/7 cable. We've got television. They didn't even have television in 1940. So we know a lot more about the world today than people did in 1940 about the world. So my question is, what will people 70 years from now think about us when looking at the things that are happening in the world and asking, well, what did we do? So part of my story is sort of a cautionary tale about us in the present, that things are happening in the world, and it's a mistake to think that America can simply isolate itself from things that are going on elsewhere in the world. We're a much smaller world than we were in 1940. Even then, two large oceans didn't ultimately protect America. And today, I think it's even more true that what happens in other places in the world doesn't stay in other places in the world. And America has a role to play, and we do as individuals.
That's a great point. So, Rick, what do you think would have happened had they assembled this army, 100,000 men, even well-equipped, well-trained against the millions on the Nazi side? Probably wouldn't have slowed them down for very long, would it have?
Well, you're correct. It wouldn't have won the war. But it certainly would have affected the strategy and tactics of the war, because one of the things I uncovered was a memo that Churchill wrote 10 days after he became the prime minister in May of 1940. And he wrote to his Secretary of State for the Colonies and said, "We have some of our best soldiers tied down in Palestine protecting the Jews from Arab attacks. And here the Jews want to form their own military force and assist us, and we're not letting them do it." And he directed the Secretary of State to start forming a Jewish unit, because he wanted those soldiers taken from Palestine and sent to other strategic areas, such as the Suez Canal, which was a key strategic area and needed to be defended, and Britain was low on troops. So had there been a Jewish force, and had it been simply in Palestine, much less other places, it would have had an impact. And Churchill himself, although he tried to get it done, couldn't get that part of it done. And that's a little sub-story that I tell in the book as well.
And that's interesting, too, because I guess the Jewish leaders lacked a little strategic perspective. Had they gotten Churchill involved in their cause, that might have been enough to actually get Americans interested in this because we were doing lend-lease, you know, sending lots of war material to the Allies in 1940, you know, from the late 30s onward. And clearly we were coming down on their side. I hate to play these what-if games, but while it wouldn't have made perhaps the ultimate difference, it would have perhaps preserved a lot of Jewish lives and put a lid on the Holocaust, perhaps, or at least mitigated it somewhat.
Yeah, you never know what would have happened if had you done something in history, but you certainly know what did happen if you didn't. So that's why I called my book "Racing Against History." Was we know what happened, but we don't know unless we know stories like this, what could have happened, and we don't know of the people who made heroic efforts that ought to be honored, and we don't have the lesson for the future if we don't know the stories of the past. And one of the great aphorisms of Harry S. Truman, his favorite one, I think, was that the only thing new is the history you don't know.
Yeah.
And you hear these stories, and they have echoes into the present. And Israel, although there's a Jewish state today, there was not one in 1940, but it's still under existential threat 70 years later. And so history is sort of what happens while you're doing something else, unless you join the issues and join the fights. And so that's part of the lesson that I'm trying to draw from this story, as seemingly a long, long time ago, but a lot of present relevance, in my opinion.
Well, you know that old saying, Rick, the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So. It's unfortunately true, but there's certain things that recur. But this is also a story about how individuals make a difference. These three guys eventually became the first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, and the first president, Chaim Weizmann. And Jabotinsky, although he didn't live to see a Jewish state, his successor was Menachem Begin, who became the first leader of the loyal opposition, and eventually he became a prime minister as well. So it's a mistake, I think, to think of history as just as these impersonal economic and political and military forces. They also are what individuals do. And if anything, I think that's why people are so surprised when I tell them the story. My God, these three guys did this. And they got a response, not from everybody, but from certainly a significant number of people. And it's a lesson to us that individuals matter.
Yeah. I just wonder why they didn't tell the story after what maybe could have been. But I think there's a lot of lessons to be drawn from here. And it's always, I always find it fascinating. You know, this is almost 80 years later, and you uncovered this kernel, this nugget of history, and now you're throwing it in all of our faces saying, all right, now what? And I think we owe you a debt of gratitude, and as well as the fact that it's a really fascinating story of three men kind of setting about something, and you know what happened afterwards. Anyways, Rick, I guess we can find the book in Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever fine books used to be sold.
Yes. If you go to Amazon, put in Rick Richmond, Racing Against History, it'll come right up.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. And we'll have a link to the Amazon listing or to your site. You have a website for this book, by the way?
Yes. It's rickrichmond.net.
Okay.
If you go there, you'll find it.
Great. We'll have a link to that site. And hey, thanks so much for coming on and sharing the story with us. Hey, as I said before, just join the conversation. Again, email address is kl@carrielutz.com, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, Facebook page Financial Survival Network. Rick, great luck on the book. Thanks so much for taking time out from your day to tell us about it.
Thank you, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.